Tonight on the show, we're talking about the science behind the road rules. Yes, I wonder whether you've ever wondered why you're required to stick to certain speeds on certain roads. What's the science behind it? Why can you go 80 k's an hour in tunnels but only 60 on local roads, for that matter? Why is it suddenly 50 on some roads? Is there any science behind it, or is it an art? Sure, it's obvious we can go faster on freeways than we can on local streets. But tonight we're going to investigate how road rules are established, the science of speed limits, and I'd love to take your questions too. 1-300-800-222. Did you know that until 2004, speed limits were set more for the convenience of optimising traffic flow rather than preventing injuries? That's less than 20 years ago. These days, safety tends to be the number one goal behind the setting of speed limits. Speed, of course, is still apparently the number one causal factor of road fatalities in Australia and plays a part in about 40% in all road deaths and costs the community in health and other related benefits, related costs, billions of dollars each year. Joining me tonight to discuss road rules, and I'd love your thoughts, 1-300-800-222, is Raphael Gibbietta from the Transport and Road Safety Research Centre, the University of New South Wales. And he joins us in the studio. Raphael, good evening. Welcome to Nightlife.
Good evening, Philip. Thanks for having me here.
Well, it's great to have you in as well. Lots of people curse and swear at all sorts of road rules. I'm often puzzled by them, I must say, as to why some road rules and some speed limits, I suppose, exist. It's interesting, though, isn't it? You're one of those, of course, behind a push that replaced the idea that road rules should be about optimising traffic flow towards a system that says road rules should be about keeping people safe. What are they about, or is it a balance?
Well, the way they're set is you look at the crashes on the particular stretch of road, the risk of someone being injured at a particular speed, and also the drivers and other road users' perception reaction time, and whether they can, if they see a hazard, they can perceive it firstly, and then secondly, whether they can react to it in time. And if the inevitable happens and a crash happens, then can they survive that incident? So that's usually how the speed limits are set. Australia actually has the highest speed limits of most of the best practice nations around the world.
Mm. Can you give us a bit of a history of it? At one stage, speed limits were set to sort of maximise traffic flow, weren't they?
Yes.
What's been the history of them?
Well, we've got such great distances between cities and towns, and so once the roads became paved, then and vehicles became much more efficient, and of course greater horsepower. People started to move at higher speeds as a result of some of the crashes. I mean, we reached a point, I think it was back in 1970, where we had the highest, our highest road toll. We were killing quite a number of people. We were killing well in excess of 3,000 people a year, and it was quite bad. And that's when we started to look at, okay, seat belts. Then along the way, we looked at alcohol and the effects of alcohol on perception reaction time. And now speed is the next sort of area where we're targeting and trying to get people to understand that if you travel at particular speeds and you have a crash, then you may not survive the crash. If you hit something solid in the best vehicle in the world and the safest vehicle in the world at a speed greater than 80 kilometres per hour, your likelihood of surviving that crash is pretty slim.
It's not really. It's not survivable, is it? A crash at 80 k's or above.
The Diana, Princess Diana crash is the classic example, one that I cite regularly, where none of the occupants were seat belted. Had they been, I suspect that Princess Diana would have survived. Fadi died, and the Rhys Jones, the bodyguard, didn't have a seatbelt, but was thrown forward to the windscreen and the dashboard. He was laid up in hospital for a very long time, but he was a supremely fit person, and so was able to survive that crash. And that crash was about 85 kilometres per hour into a solid column. In a Mercedes, mind you, which was the safest car at that time.
Which at the time was the safest car around.
Yeah.
Yeah. If crashes aren't really survivable above 80 Ks, why do we bother with speed limits above 80 Ks?
Well, that's a good question, and in fact, that is being proposed now for a lot of rural roads. We've had a number of road safety experts suggest that we should be setting rural roads where there are hard points like trees, bridge abutments, and where we can cross over and have a head-on. We should be setting those to 80 kilometres per hour. If we have a median barrier of some kind and we have fairly large clear zones on either side of the road where we can run off and shed speed and brake, then we can raise the speed limit. And you find that the major freeways have exactly that. They're at 100, 110 kilometres per hour, because if you do lose control, then you don't come to a sudden stop. What happens is you are deflected against a barrier. You skid. You eventually get pulled up. And so that's why the freeways tend to have higher speeds.
How do we arrive at the speed, though? How do we arrive at 100 or 110, for example? I mean, there's no speed limit in Australia that's higher than 110. There was for a little while in the Northern Territory, I think, wasn't there?
I think there still is in the Northern Territory, isn't there? I think it's 130.
On some parts of the Stuart Highway,
some
maybe.
Some parts of the Stuart Highway,
Okay, but generally it's 110. How do we arrive at 110 k's an hour?
Well, usually it's all about perception reaction time. And so if you're travelling along a road and then you suddenly see a hazard, then how far a distance would you travel before you have to effectively pull up or avoid the incident? And so that range of 100 and 110 is perceived as, for such major freeways, is perceived as an appropriate speed to be able to pull up safely in a modern vehicle. But you'll shed a lot of speed. If you hit another vehicle, though, at that speed,
it's not
you're in big trouble if that vehicle's stationary.
Yeah. Why? I mean, often when you're driving it on a freeway and it's not particularly congested, 110 seems awfully slow. Would it make any difference if it was 120, for example?
Well, you would still in a new car, very comfortable car, you would probably not feel it, but you would feel it once you strike something. 120 kilometres per hour coming to a sudden stop is like driving off the roof of a 14-storey building. Now, tell me, Phil, would you hop into a car, strap yourself in, and drive off the top of a 14-storey building, hoping you might survive?
Probably not.
I think it'd be...
but on a freeway, you're not likely to come to a sudden stop, though, are you? Because
no, that's right.
Freeways are almost all, well, not exclusively, but mostly divided roads. So the traffic's all moving in the same direction. You're not going to run into something coming the other way or run into something stationary unless you left the road.
There have been instances where there've been hazards like fog. Is one in the UK. There have been some very horrific crashes on their motorways where people have driven in at high speeds into stationary cars. There could be also someone who's broken down. There have been some pretty major incidents where vehicles are being repaired in that sort of emergency lane, but they didn't quite have enough room in the emergency lane. The vehicles sort of protruding a little bit outside of that, and vehicles have struck them. There's a couple of pretty famous cases in regards to those types of horrific impacts. Likewise, you can't guarantee that you wouldn't hit an animal as well. So if there's a kangaroo or some other animal, hitting it at high speed can be quite dangerous. I'm not sure if you've heard also about those incidents where some youths have dropped rocks on cars on a freeway, and it's killed the occupants. So it's a pretty high speed. Obviously, we can travel at high speeds. We do that all the time in aircraft. And in fact, our planet rotates at a very high speed. It's when it stops, if something gets in the way and brings it to a halt and there's large decelerations, then you're in trouble. Now, from what we sort of know from our design experience, it's about 20 Gs is really somewhere between 10 to 20 Gs, 10 to 20 times the weight of your body. You can tolerate that deceleration for a short duration. But above that, that's when you really start to where your body really starts to be abused by the kinetic force.
What actually kills you? It's I understand in a lot of these accidents, it's not so much the impact of something; it's the displacement, in particular, of often of your internal organs.
That's correct. Usually, and in fact, there was a classic case of a Mercedes that had struck a bridge pillar at about 85 kilometres per hour. The driver was inside, the airbag went off, the seat belts were all activated. It's got a crumple zone at the front, and yet the driver was dead. And the heart had moved forward. The brain within the skull had moved. Your organs and the soft material relative to the harder parts of your skeleton move around. Inside impacts, it's quite common to see people with ruptured aortas being presented at hospitals. It's one of the things that you need to look out for when someone's been in a T-bone intersection crash. We know how people get injured and struck in certain crashes. Pedestrian crashes, for example, it's usually the head and the brain within the skull that that suffers the blunt force trauma.
You say that Australia's got some of the highest speeds. I've driven on the American interstates. People drive faster than that on those.
Yes, but the U.S. is one of the worst countries. They really are.
In general, when I was driving in the U.S. on the interstates, you really needed to drive around about 125, 130 just to keep up with traffic.
Yes, they really don't enforce speed to the extent that the Europeans do. And in fact, in the US, they're starting to acknowledge speed as being an issue. But the US is ranked one of the last alongside third world countries in terms of their road safety performance per 100,000 population and per 10,000 vehicles. They're not very well regarded in terms of their safety performance in the OECD nations. Australia ranks about middle, and the European countries are the ones that Sweden and the UK and Holland.
I must say I've driven in Italy too on their freeways, and they drive faster than we do.
Yes, it depends very much on the politics of the country. I did a bit of work in Romania, and the speeds there are very high and very poor infrastructure, and that combination is really bad. They're the worst performers of the European Union nations. And yet their politicians, when you talk to them and you want to convince them that maybe they should reduce their speed limits, particularly in the city areas. I mean, I saw cars driving at 60 kilometres per hour where in the middle of the city where there are pedestrians crossing all the time, continuous conflict between cars and pedestrians. And yet they don't want to listen to it because it's an imposition on them politically. They're concerned about their votes, I suppose. And it's not dissimilar to what's happened in New South Wales with the point-to-point speed cameras and policing trying to get vehicles to slow down in New South Wales.
Just turning to local roads, where does the 60, 80, 50 division come from?
Well, 50 used to be higher, actually. That was something we achieved a number of years ago when we wanted those urban streets to have a lower limit because there's what's called a survivable crash, okay? And there's a fatality risk at a pedestrian being struck at 60 kilometres per hour has almost a 90% to 95% chance of dying if struck at 60. At 50, they're struck at they've got about an 85% chance. So 50 is already high in an urban environment. That's why you see work zones and you see school out the front of schools 40 kilometre per hour limit, which is roughly about a 40% chance of being killed if you get struck by a car travelling at that speed.
What can a pedestrian survive at? I mean, what can they
survive? 30 is really the speed that is being adopted by European countries, best practice European countries. You'll find that throughout the Scandinavian countries, Netherlands, UK, where if you're off the main arterial roads or you're travelling in amongst houses where there are children, where there are people walking, there's a lot of pedestrians, 30 is really the limit that should be set. But we've always balked at bringing that speed limit down.
You'd never get anywhere. Although, mind you, in some parts of our big cities, if you can go 30, you're probably doing well.
Yes, exactly right. And that's what we found in Sydney at one time. We did a study where we measured the speeds in the CBD. Mm. The average speed was about 30 kilometres per hour, so why not?
Mm. What about surviving a crash? You say above 80 k's if you hit something solid like a tree at 80 k's or above, the chances of surviving, and well, there's not much chance of surviving. That might surprise some people who think I could run into a tree at 100 and survive. You probably won't. What can you run into something solid at and expect to survive in a modern car?
Well, the new car assessment program that people are possibly familiar with, the Stars on Cars, those tests are run into deformable barriers at about, I think it's 67 kilometres per hour or something of that order, 65 kilometres per hour. And so that's a vehicle that is deformable, has a crushable front, and also it impacts a crushable barrier. And so that's run at that speed, you should be able to walk away from the vehicle. You'll have bruising from the seat belts. You'll be shaken up pretty badly. The airbags will go off, of course, and hopefully protect you. But that's a speed at which a crash can occur that you can walk away from.
67.
Now, it's somewhere of that order into deformable systems, not into a solid. Into a solid system, in other words, a bridge abutment.
Or a tree.
Or a tree. Yeah, you're talking somewhere in the order of about 60 kilometres per hour. You don't want to hit it much harder than that, at a higher speed than that, or decelerate, where you come to a full stop. I'm talking about coming to a full stop. Quite often people will hit trees and the vehicle will rotate, so it'll keep on going. So the deceleration is not as severe as what happened in the Princess Diana crash, where that came to a full stop. So people tend to shed speed and decelerate at a lower level in most crashes. That's why you find people will survive a crash and said, "Oh, I was going at 100 kilometres per hour and I impacted this other vehicle, et cetera, et cetera." And when I start to quiz them and ask them a little bit more about, okay, did your car continue to move and skid, and did the other vehicle get crushed, et cetera, and you find that there's quite a bit of energy dissipated in all those various small little impacts, yeah.
What's been the biggest improver of survivability and crash death? Has it been speed limits, or has it been improvements in the cars themselves?
Oh, it's a range of things, actually. It's safer. There's what we call now the safe system approach, where you look at the safer vehicles, safer roads, and safer speeds. And it's that combination of the three, as well as being an alert driver. And so what we're finding is that if you've got a five-star NCAP vehicle, in other words, it's got all the airbags and seat belts, et cetera, it's gone through that more rigorous testing regime. If you've got a road where you've got barriers, they can be different types of barriers. There's concrete barriers, there's the W-beam steel barriers, which are a bit more flexible, and then the wire rope barriers, which are very flexible. And so if it's got barriers protecting the hard points, and likewise, you've got to have good grip on the road, so good asphalt, so that when you brake, you get a high coefficient of friction on your tyres. Your tyres are critical. I cannot emphasise enough the value of your tyres to keep them as good as possible for that braking, because that's what's saving you. And then your alertness and not having any alcohol in you, or having any sort of drugs, be they medicinal or even illegal.
Sure.
You don't want to numb your brain. That's the point here. Don't numb your brain and be on the ball as you're driving.
Mm. All right, let's take some calls. 1-300-800-222. 1-300-800-222. Dennis, you've been waiting on there. Hi, Den.
Yes, hi. I've got a few comments to make. First is a question, and that is, what are the problems with people holding their seatbelts away from their chests? You see this quite often, and I am aware that the seatbelt can stretch when you brake suddenly. That's the question. The other comments I have, having done post-mortems, people need to realize that the energy in a car is proportional to the square of the speed of the car. So as you increase the speed, the energy increases tremendously. And finally, there's the problem of the driver health and snoring and sleep apnea, and we haven't got enough awareness of that. So one is what happens when people hold their seatbelts away from their body. Two is the kinetic energy. The third comment is, and I see too many snorers who've done nothing about it.
Hmm. Sure. Okay. Yeah. Rafael, the issue of seatbelts, I mean, the evidence is in on seatbelts, isn't it? They work.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yes.
What about holding the seatbelt away from you that Dennis is worried about?
Yeah, there could be a legitimate situation where a seatbelt is irritating someone on the neck. We've seen that. It happens with truck drivers. And what we like to see is adjustable seatbelts. If that seatbelt is irritating you, then you should have it seen to, looked at in terms of adjusting the height of it. It should be above your shoulder. If it's below your shoulder, then you're risking crushing your spine. But it should be above, and quite often the what we call all belts to seats. In other words, the seat belts are integrated within the seat itself, as opposed to being on the B pillar, which is the pillar right next to you. The A pillar is the front pillar.
What's wrong with that?
What's wrong with what? Sorry.
What's wrong with the seatbelts being on the pillars rather than on. You're saying it's better if they're in the, well, on the seat themselves.
It will then better contour your body. It's closer to being over your shoulder as opposed away from your shoulder, and that's what can sometimes be irritating for some people as well. And rubbing up against the neck is another issue.
All right, Tony. Hello.
Yeah, g'day, Phil, and your distinguished grand guest. 3 points. One, we're one nation. Why have we got so many different road rules between each and every state? Two, why do they allow push bikes on a 100K freeway when there is a bike lane or a bike way with less than 20 feet away? And one particular road I know of are in Western Sydney. It's about probably 30 kilometres long, but it has about 7 or 8 different speed limits.
All right. Raphael, are the rules between states very different?
Oh, they're standardising them. They're trying to. There is a regular meeting between the various jurisdictions. That occurs one's coming up now in Sydney where there is a meeting between the various regulators and police as well. Mm-hmm. And so there is that move to try and make them all under one set of rules. I mean, we do have the Australian Road Rules, which is a federal requirement. But it's difficult with politics. As I was saying before with New South Wales, they haven't turned on the point-to-point speed cameras because that happened to be an election promise. So they bartered lives with an election promise, and it's been like that now for about 3 or 4 years. A lot of us have really tried very hard to convince the minister to turn those point-to-point speed cameras, which is a lot fairer for drivers. Single cameras, you could be just over the speed limit just for a moment. You know, you've lost your concentration for a moment, and it's a bit unfair. Whereas over a longer distance, if you've got point to point, it's much fairer. We're a bit concerned about that in regards to that. But likewise, Northern Territory, there've been politics involved in that as well. Each state has its right to govern itself. So, unfortunately, road rules come into that. Mm-hmm. I think road rules should be bipartisan requirements, politics should really not come into it. It's really about making sure people are safe on the road.
Sarah, hello.
Good evening, Phil. Good evening, Raphael.
Good
evening. I have a niece by marriage who lives in Germany, who's an orthopaedic surgeon over there.
Yep.
And she's been over there for about 7 or 8 years now. And Autobahn, when she first got on it, she was terrified because they're all doing at least 160, sometimes in the fog, in thick morning traffic doing the commute. And from what they're saying, she's an orthopaedic surgeon, her husband's a trauma surgeon, they're not losing lives left, right and centre, so what gives? How come Autobahn's successful but in Australia non-feasible?
Okay,
Raphael.
Yeah, sure. That's a very good point, Sarah. The thing is that their roads are of an extremely high quality. They have appropriate barriers. They have the appropriate roads properly designed, set up so that you can travel at those higher speeds. Contrary to what a lot of people think, there are a number of those roads that have been reduced. The speed has been reduced. What you find is that when you reduce the speed, the average speed of the vehicles by something like about somewhere anywhere between 5 to 10%, you're getting gains of somewhere between 20 to 30. That's been proven as a result. And once again, we go back to Dennis when he said the kinetic energy is equal to the velocity squared times mass and half of that. And so it's
That raises another question then. Why mm-hmm. aren't we vociferously advocating, because we have such huge distances in this country, mm-hmm. for roads to be incredibly improved so they are at the standards that we need for people to travel huge distances a little more fast, a little safer, a lot safer? Why don't we have German standard roads in a country where the road is so important?
Yeah, that's a valid point. But fair the problem is, it is a fair question, absolutely, and we push for it all the time. However, we have very few taxpayers. We have a very small tax bucket to draw from, and the country the size of the US. So it is what we have done in Australia is stunning in comparison to the problem that we have, the vast expanse that we have. So we've done extremely well. And unfortunately, if you haven't got the funds to sink into the infrastructure and make those roads, you know, the sort of world-class roads, then the only way to control that is through speed. And that's what we're doing as a nation.
Okay. Thanks, Sarah.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Good on you, Sarah. No, interesting. No, they're good questions. My texter says, Top Gear once did a car hit a wall at 50 miles an hour. That's, what's that, 80 k's? And a driver walked out thanks to airbags. Is that likely?
Well, you can, yes. Yeah. Look, it just depends on the distance. And, in fact, there is one of the most famous researchers in the world, Colonel Stapp. He strapped himself into a rocket seat and then decelerated himself to very large decelerations, the order of hundreds of Gs, and survived. But the reason was that he strapped himself in such a way that his body didn't move. Unfortunately, he suffered eye damage. But he wanted to prove a point that the human body is capable of tolerating very high G levels, but at very short durations. The other thing is also that if you've got a long enough distance, crushable distance, then you can survive such decelerations. For example, people stunt men jump from buildings into airbags. So if you calculate it appropriately, you can survive any type of impact, so long as you've got enough time to decelerate.
Okay. All right. Mark's got an interesting question. Yes, Mark?
I just wanted to know, you keep saying that 80 kilometres an hour is fairly much a fatal impact.
Not really survivable if you hit a solid object. Yeah.
Not survivable if you hit a
solid object. Well, it is survivable, but it's at the absolute border, limits.
Okay. So what I wanted to know, if you're on a country road, because you're saying country roads are talking about reducing the speed limit to 80 kilometres an hour, if you have a vehicle travelling in the opposite direction doing 80 kilometres an hour and you have a head-on impact with that vehicle, that is the equivalent of hitting a stationary object at 160 kilometres an hour, isn't it?
That's correct.
Okay, so in that case, even at 80 kilometres an hour, both of those cars, all occupants, would be dead going off the numbers that you're stating. So would you therefore, if you're basing all your numbers on safety and loss of life, say that on Australian roads where there's no centre divider, the speed limit should be no greater than 40 kilometres an hour?
No. 80 kilometres per hour, what you'll find is that the vehicles to hit flush on, they tend not to hit flush on. They tend to hit offset. That's why you'll notice in the new car assessment program, the stars on cars, you'll see that there's a 50% offset into the deformable barrier. That deformable barrier mimics a vehicle coming the other way. And so at 80 kilometres per hour, if you've got another vehicle coming at you that is with equivalent crashworthiness, that is just survivable. Quite often you'll find people will brake, and so they will shed some speed. So, and also it's not just the impact, it's also the perception reaction time that you have to identify there's a hazard, identify that there's someone on the other side of the road coming at you, and so you can take evasive action. So it's not just the impact speed that counts here, it's also how you react to a sudden hazard if someone's fallen asleep at the wheel on the other side of the road and it's coming at you.
Okay, but if you had two drivers that fell asleep, they both had a dead head-on impact at 40 kilometres an hour, they would all die. That's what you're saying?
Well, they would be very seriously injured, if not dead. As I said, the Diana crash was in the safest vehicle at 85 kilometres per hour to a dead stop. So that gives you the upper limit. So you come back from that. Remember, you've got airbags, you've got seat belts. You'll probably have a broken sternum in a crash like that. If you happen to be exceedingly unlucky to be in that situation, because both drivers falling asleep, two cars hitting each other, flush on 100%, is a highly unusual case.
Okay.
All right.
Can I just ask one other quick thing?
Quickly, Mark, yeah.
Has there been any research done on how fast a motorcyclist can survive a wire rope barrier?
Yes.
Interesting. Well, as a motorcyclist myself, I'm interested in the accident.
There was a lot of controversy about this.
There was, actually, wasn't there? Motorcyclists didn't like the wire barriers, yeah.
Well, you're speaking... Sorry, my apologies.
No, they still don't like the wire rope barriers, but... you know, I'm out near Bendigo, and the entire freeway to Melbourne is almost wire rope. It's
yeah, like that's true. Raphael, is there any research on this?
Yes, I've actually done the most amount of research in the world on this particular topic. So there's if you go to the Transport and Road Safety TARS webpage. At UNSW, and you find motorcycle into barriers, you'll see our extensive research, four major reports. There's something like about 20-odd papers. We've done quite a bit of work. The wire rope barriers aren't the issue here. It's actually W-beam guardrail type barriers that are really dangerous for motorcyclists. Now, what happens is and they're very small numbers. You're talking only 6% of motorcycle fatalities that where there's someone that strikes a barrier. Now, the issue here is that the wire rope barrier will prevent other vehicles coming across the road and taking out the motorcyclist. Now, that happens in about 40 to 50% of the time. And so there have been reductions wherever wire rope barriers have been put into the median, there have been reductions in motorcycle fatalities of that order. Now, the other issue is motorcyclists, when they strike a barrier, they split themselves into two categories. There's those that slide into the barrier, and there's those that sit upright and go over the barrier. And so those that go upright will either go into the oncoming traffic or into the hazard that the barrier is protecting, or in the and that's about a quarter of them, and the other quarter will slide along the top of the barrier. Now, I can tell you the W-beam barriers with the Charlie posts, with the C-sections that stick up, they're not very friendly. They're like a chainsaw, and they'll just rip a motorcycle. We've seen some horrific injuries on those. So the wire rope barriers, they'll tend to just go straight over those. It's the posts that are the problem. And so what we're looking at is whether we can come up with a frangible post. Because the posts are simply there to hold the wire rope in place.
Mm-hmm.
And so if we can come up with a frangible post,
by frangible, you mean breakable, do you?
That's right. So it would break. The load. I mean, each of our body, parts. So our legs, our arms, etc., have certain load tolerance limits before they are either broken. The bone is broken, or limb can be severed. So what we're trying to do is make them frangible enough so that the body part will not react overtly against with a high blunt trauma against one of those posts. So very difficult problem to solve, but we're working on it.
Yeah. Would that then make them too weak for trucks and cars, though?
No. The post is only there to hold the barrier, to hold the wire in place.
The wire
in place. It's got no strength requirements whatsoever.
All Okay. Okay. Thanks,
Thank you,
Mark.
Very much.
Interesting. Yeah, just one more motorcycles, motorcycling, Raphael. If you come off your motorcycle, the chances of you surviving at any speed aren't that high, are they?
That's right. Anything above 40 kilometres per hour, you're effectively a pedestrian with a machine strapped to you.
Yes.
You're sitting on a machine. That's really what you are. Except motorcyclists, in fairness, do have helmets. Some wear appropriate leathers and body armour, but you're pretty much like a pedestrian being flung at high speed. So preferably what motorcyclists want is clear space.
That's right.
They don't want to hit anything.
I can tell you that as a motorcyclist myself. That's right. That's what we love. We love just plenty of space around us.
That's right.
At all times, yeah. All right. Over, I think is the pronunciation, with a question which is interesting too. Hi, Over.
Hi. Coming from Sweden, where for the last 40 years, every car, as soon as the engine runs, the lights go on. Norway and Austria, I believe, have followed suit. What stops regulation to be put in place that as soon as the engine runs, the car lights go on? How many times have you seen a car, why didn't they put on the lights?
That's what happens on my motorcycle, by the way, over here. Every time I turn it on, the light is on.
Yes,
you can't turn it off, actually.
I'm a rider myself, so I take it.
Yeah.
But even aircraft, trucks, Why not make it compulsory so you don't have another car forgetting switching on the light at 5 o'clock on a winter night when it rains, like tonight?
Raphael?
There was some pushback from the motorcyclists, actually, in regards to that, though that was overcome. That was a couple of decades ago. And so because the motorcyclists wanted to be conspicuous in traffic with their lights on. However, you'll find that the more modern vehicles now do have that and have that when you turn the vehicle on, the lights will come on. I know in my vehicle I can turn them off, and so it's about a six-year-old vehicle. So, I tend to agree with you. I think we should have all lights on.
Thank you.
Okay. All right. Richard, hello. G'day, Richard. Are you there, Richard? Are you still there with us?
Hello.
Yeah, Richard. Hi.
It's not Richard here, but it's Alex, but that doesn't matter.
Oh, okay. Sorry. Yeah, so okay. Alex, Alex, hello.
Hi. Hi. Look, I was going to say something else, but first, you made a slight error there when that chap talked about two cars hitting each other head-on, 80 kilometres an hour each. And you said that's a closing speed of 160, but the effect is identical to hitting a solid stone wall at 80, because each car, if they're identical cars, has a crumple zone. So each car stops the same way, and they don't get pushed backwards. Therefore, it's exactly the same as a car at 80 hitting a solid stone wall or a tree or something that doesn't give way.
Raphael?
Yeah, I'd agree with that. Yes, absolutely. That's if they've got both got the same crush characteristics.
That's right, yeah, that's right. That's why a heavier car and different crush characteristics make a difference.
Yeah.
But
absolutely.
Also, the chance of something happening perfectly in any crash is very unlikely. All sorts of things can happen. You can get killed at 40 and survive at 100 because of circumstances.
That's correct.
But the biggest problem in the country here is that the speed limits are, on good roads we're talking about, very soporific. They tend to cause accidents, and rather than trying to survive an accident, why not try and stop having that accident by actually having speed limits that are more appropriate for the roads?
Well, here's a dilemma for you. At the moment, if you go out in your car, see if you can identify a pedestrian with your low beam lights on. I'll bet you won't be able to stop that car from hitting the pedestrian at any speed above about 35 kilometres per hour if you've got them on low beam. And
sure.
Yet we have speed limits everywhere at 50 kilometres per hour in the urban areas and 60 in other areas. We have appropriate lighting in those high-risk areas, but yet we tolerate that. In Europe, they've set their speed limits in urban areas, in darker areas, at 30 kilometres per hour. They know about this.
Look, that's fine for small distances, but when we're travelling large distances in the country, then it's a totally different set of rules. You've got to look at the psychology of the drivers rather than what happens when they crash into a tree. I want to stop them crashing into a tree. And I bet you, if on good sections of the road, like if you go north of Newcastle, for example, the Bulla Dealer bypass, on those sort of roads, 130 would be a perfect speed limit. I set my cruise control at 110 by my GPS because if I don't, I'm always going over the speed limit. So I set it at 110. And I tell you what, my brother calls it a snooze control, and there's a good reason for it. It is just too slow when there's no traffic. You can see a cockroach at 200 metres. There's no problem in the country there. Mm. And yet, that's where it's policed the most.
Yeah, yes, okay. And you appropriately named it snooze control, and that's the problem, isn't it? And so if you fall asleep, then at that sort of speed, hitting a tree or another vehicle, then your chances of surviving at 130 are just
zero.
Not zero, but I mean, it depends what you hit and how you hit it.
As you say, yeah.
But it is very, very slim chance of surviving. And so the reasons it's also set for at 80 kilometres per hour is because the roads are narrower as well. And so you need to have an appropriate time available to you to perceive and react to any potential hazard. If a kangaroo jumps out at you, if someone else falls asleep at the wheel and comes at you, or someone's not doesn't make it in time to when they're passing another vehicle to get back into their lane. The issue here is not just kinetic energy. It is also about the time available to you and the stopping distance. Stopping distance is critical in these types of incidents, or the distance on which you can apply your brakes and your brakes slow you down. So at 130 kilometres per hour, it takes you quite a long time to shed speed. You don't shed it until right at the end of the process. Of braking.
Okay. 1-300-800-222. We're talking with Raphael Giavietta from the Transport and Road Safety Research Centre about road rules and the science and research behind them. James, hi.
Hello there.
Hi.
Great information about those wire-rope barriers for motorcycle riders. That was interesting. Thank you, Raphael. Mm-hmm. I appreciate that. I was wondering if there's any... I appreciate that you've covered off a lot on the physics of it all, but I was interested more in terms of statistics, in terms of if we increased, for example, on good roads where we have, say, wire rope barriers or et cetera, if we increased our speed limits to 120, what sort of an impact would that have on our on the statistics overall?
Do we know that, Raphael?
Well, yes, there's been quite a bit of work done on that. And in fact, if there's appropriate systems placed into the infrastructure that will assist you in, firstly, waking you up, making you perceive what's going on around you. So, you know, you'll see the rumble strips, there's the emergency lanes, you've got a wide enough emergency lane to pull over. And attend to something if you've got a problem, and then there's the grip of the road as well. So you've got to have a high grip asphalt that is or concrete, depending if it's a concrete road. In the US, they tend to use concrete quite a bit, and so you've got to have that good coefficient of friction, where you can pull up fairly quickly if you decide to apply your brakes, or in cornering as well. Cornering is particularly hazardous for low friction roads, and so it really depends on what you've got installed on that road as to how you're going to how are you going to survive the crash? Now, risk, usually what happens is there's a
crash. We'll just wind it up quickly because we're up against the news bulletin, but go on.
Oh, sorry. So it really depends on the risk of the crash, and sure. They assess the risk of the crash, and when you put in the countermeasures, that reduces the risk.
Mm. Fascinating conversation, Raphael. I really appreciate your expertise too. It's been eye-opening in lots of ways. Thanks for your time.
Welcome. Thank you, Philip. Thanks for having me on the show.
Raphael Gibbietta from the Transport and Road Safety Research Centre at the University of New South Wales. Fascinating stuff, isn't it?